Let's open our Bibles to Ecclesiastes, which you already know where it is, even as we speak. You know, it's interesting, this time of year, I don't know about you, but I have to fight some fairly serious skepticism as we go down to the mall and we go to town. There's just this influx of people because it's Christmas time. It's the big shopping thing. And I come into the Christmas season every year with a kind of a mixed feeling. I don't know if you have the same mixed feeling. It's fairly common among Christians. The idea is, if it's Jesus' birth, how come the world seems to miss it? And it produces in me a sense of sort of cynicism. It bothers me. And yet, I know inside I should be joyful, because it is Jesus' birth. It's the time that we celebrate his incarnation and so on. It's wonderful from that perspective. Yet somehow something gets tarnished. The world knows just a little bit, but doesn't know enough, it seems, about Jesus. They know the name. They know a little bit about who he is. And we've sort of turned it into merchandise in a lot of ways. And so there's this mixed feeling, sort of this ambivalence, maybe a little bit of cynicism and skepticism. You know, it's an interesting thing about skepticism. I came across this definition of it, and it's true, it's from Webster's. A skeptic is a person who doubts the validity or authenticity of something that purports to be factual. Do you ever feel like that? Do you ever call yourself a skeptic? I don't mean in the sense of not believing in God necessarily, but in just looking out at the world with sort of a jaundiced eye. You know, it's an interesting thing that God leaves a lot of room for skepticism. He really does. All through his word, he leaves room for people to be angry, to doubt, to be frustrated. In fact, the term frustrate actually comes from a Latin term which means vanity. It means emptiness. It means meaninglessness. And the feeling of frustration that comes into our lives is a feeling that says, what I'm doing doesn't make sense. It's not happening the way I want it to. I'm trying and nothing good is happening from it. In God's word, we find over and over again that the Lord not only leaves room for skepticism, but he actually uses it. If you're a person who doubts and fears and looks around and feels cynical and hopeless sometimes, I'm not saying that's a happy headspace to be in, but I am saying there's plenty of room for it in God's word, because we live in a fallen world. And the book of Ecclesiastes is actually a book written from the perspective of skepticism. It is a book actually dedicated to the idea that the world is essentially meaningless. It's a unique book, and people who read it tend to sort of misunderstand it, at least certain portions of it, and some folks who read it just get completely depressed. In fact, I have a question for you. How many of you have ever actually sat down and read Ecclesiastes completely through? Several of you. Good. You know, in an average group of folks that you ask that, most of them will say, no, I've read the first couple chapters and kind of moved on into something else that was a little happier, because the material seems so cynical. But what we're going to find in our study of Ecclesiastes, and it's only going to be a survey, we're going to find that it's actually not depressing, believe it or not. You're going to see that what the moral of the story of Ecclesiastes is far from depressing. Unless, of course, you want your life to be centered on the things that are here in this world. If that's what you want, then Ecclesiastes is incredibly depressing, okay? We're only going to cover the first two chapters, but before we do that, I want to just talk a little bit about the book itself. Ecclesiastes, the term, the title, comes from from a Greek translation of a Hebrew word, which is koheleth, which means preacher or assembly person, the guy who gathers people together. And it comes from the very first verse, the words of the preacher, if you're reading a New American Standard, the words of a preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. That Hebrew word, koheleth, simply means assembly person, a person who gathers people. And the Greek term for that is Ecclesiastes. And so in the Septuagint, that's what the book was called. And people pretty much assume that Solomon wrote it. He probably did, although you need to know there are some arguments about that. Some people don't think he wrote it. There's no question it belongs in the canon of Scripture. There's no question that what it says is inspired. But some people debate about Solomonic authorship. We're going to assume he wrote it. And I'll tell you why. Just in case you're a person who reads extra notes and reads extra books on the subject of Bible books, or maybe you're reading a study Bible, and you've got notes in your study Bible that actually discuss Whether Solomon wrote this or not, let me tell you why I'm assuming he did. Number one, the tradition holds that he did, and I think that's a strong reason. Number two, whoever wrote it was a king in Jerusalem who had incredible wealth and incredible power and incredible wisdom, which he describes for himself. And that fits Solomon like a glove. That's, you know, when you read it through, the profile fits him perfectly. And third, if anybody had an opportunity to talk about what the world has to offer and tell us that it really isn't enough, it would have to be Solomon. So I'm assuming Solomon wrote it, and I think it's a safe assumption. So when we go through it, I'm going to just refer to him as the author. Even if you have notes in the margins of your Bible that question whether or not he authored it, I don't think there's a whole lot of question, and we're going to make the assumption. The subject is wisdom. This is still wisdom literature. We've been talking about wisdom, Proverbs, and Psalms, and Job. And what is the nature of wisdom literature? Do you guys remember what the nature of wisdom literature is in the Bible? What God is doing with it? Why he put it in his book? Do you remember what it was? It's how to make your life work. Wisdom is how to make your life work. What makes life happen correctly? In terms of day-to-day life, wisdom literature in the Bible is God's word about daily life, including all the joys and all the sorrows, all the ups and all the downs, all the hassles of living in a fallen world, and trusting God in a fallen world, which is very hard to do at times. All of that is what wisdom literature deals with. And sometimes it's harsh. Wisdom literature sometimes says harsh things, and even things that we wish it didn't say. There's some portions of wisdom literature that are so graphic that sometimes when we read it, it really bothers us, and it bothers our churchiness, really. I sometimes think God is not nearly as churchy as we are. I sometimes wonder if he would be uncomfortable in churches at times. I mean, I wonder sometimes if the Lord Jesus, if he walked into some churches, we might not appreciate what he had to say, because sometimes God's word can be so earthy, so real, that it pokes us in places we don't want to be poked. And wisdom literature does this. It pokes us in places we don't want to be poked. It talks about stuff we'd rather leave at home rather than hear about it in church. But that's the nature of wisdom, and I'll tell you why. It's because it's the nature of life. Listen, you guys, when you gave your life to Jesus, you gave everything to him. You may not have thought that, but you just didn't read the fine print. He took it all. Everything belongs to him. All the depression, all the hassle, all the bad decisions, your sex life, your business life, everything you do with every penny that you own, it all belongs to him. He says, I'm taking it all. I'm redeeming it all. Not just one day a week. I'm taking the whole mess, and I'm just washing it clean so that it all belongs to me now. The whole thing totally belongs to me. Not just at church on Sundays and Wednesday nights. The whole thing. That's what happened when you gave your life to Jesus. And that's why wisdom literature is kind of graphic at times. And as a matter of fact, it's why wisdom literature sometimes deals with depressing subjects. Because your life is depressing sometimes. I know it's not nice to talk about that at church, discuss depression and being bummed out and how faith doesn't seem to be working really well right this minute in some people's lives. But that's actually the nature of the life of faith. It has its ups and downs. So we get into Ecclesiastes, and it is a unique look at wisdom literature. It's different than all the other wisdom books. Ecclesiastes comes to its wisdom, but not through the front door. All the rest of them come pretty much through the front door. Job sort of comes in the side. The rest of them come straight in from the beginning of worshiping God. All the wisdom books start out by saying, we begin by worshiping God, and then after we have begun that way, then we look at all the difficulties of life. Ecclesiastes is unique, and it's one of the reasons I love it. Believe it or not, I love this book. And one of the reasons is because it doesn't do it that way. It comes in completely through the back door. Do you guys have front doors and back doors? How many of you do not use your front doors? We never use our front door. When our kids actually rang the front doorbell and surprised us, I thought it was Jehovah's Witnesses at the door. So I like back doors. You know, when you come to our house, it's always through the garage and in the back door. That's the way everybody comes in. It's interesting to me that Ecclesiastes is a backdoor view of wisdom. What happens is that the writer, Koheleth, or Solomon, the preacher, actually begins from a skeptical vantage point. He starts out by saying, I hate everything. I hate everything. I hate life. It's all a big mess. I don't like it. You will not find that view anywhere else in the Scriptures as the beginning point of any books of the Bible. Blech! So you open it and you say, shall we read God's word? And we read it. Blah! I hate this. Oh, really? Well, see, that's got my attention. I actually like the fact that it gets our attention that way. That it comes in the back. And what it does is it says, we're going to find meaning by finding out all the ways that you can't find meaning first. So we're going to come at it the wrong way, in a sense. We're going to come at it through the back door, up from underneath. We're going to find all the things that go wrong. It was said that Thomas Edison, when he was inventing the light bulb, went through, I forget how many, 500 or 1,000 things that didn't work. I forget. It was a big number. And they said, aren't you depressed? And he says, no, we found this number of things that don't work. Sooner or later, we're going to find the right one. Well, that's exactly the way Ecclesiastes works. It comes at wisdom, but it is very real wisdom. When you get through Ecclesiastes, you should have a realistic view of life that, surprisingly enough, allows you to really actually enjoy life. And we're going to see how the book actually comes to that conclusion, even though he talks a lot about the lousy things that happen in our lives. So it's unique, even in wisdom literature. It's the only book of its kind in the whole Bible. And even in wisdom literature, which is a small segment of Scripture, it's unique in that way. There's two main themes. The first is, blah, verse 1 and 2 of chapter 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, says Koheleth, the preacher. Vanity of vanities, says the Ecclesiastes. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. He repeats it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times in a verse and a half. It's all emptiness. That's theme number 1. This life is completely empty. And he goes on and he says it several times. He says he actually hates it from one particular vantage point. The Hebrew word that's used, and it's the theme of the book. In fact, if you think he doesn't carry the theme through, look at the last chapter. Chapter 12, verse 8. You'd say, well, maybe by the time he gets to the end, he's happier. Yeah, right. And the end of the book, chapter 12, verse 8, vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. Okay, so it's one of the main, if not the main, themes throughout the book, but you'll see it's a special kind of vanity that he has in mind. The Hebrew word hebel is the Hebrew word for vanity here. It can be rendered by so many different words that there are literally dozens of translations out that each render this in different meaninglessness, vapor, breath. The word can mean breath. You could use it of fog. fog, all is fog. Actually, that kind of works. Especially if fog is kind of depressing to you. You know, fog, all is fog. But the reason that he says it is because the Hebrew word implies that it's something that looks like it ought to be something, but when you get close to it, it's nothing. It's something that promises that it's there, but it's really, you know, when you fly and you look at the clouds, they are there, but on the other hand, they're not there. You fly right through them. It's like, poof, poof. You look down on them, you think, I could jump out and land in that. It's like cotton. It looks so thick and so real. And yet the plane begins to descend into that, and it's gone. It's just gone as soon as you hit it. Well, you know what? That's this Hebrew word. And what he's saying is life, when you try to grasp it, and you try to hold on to it, and you try to understand it, and you try to make it make sense, and you try to look for ultimate reality, you reach out there, and it's like fog. It goes away. Well, I've been working all this time for such and so thing, this particular, and I knew I'd be fulfilled if only I had this one thing. We used to have a standing joke at the place where I used to work where we would tell each other, this will really make me happy. As soon as anybody would buy anything, we would tease each other, is that going to make you happy now? Oh, yes. And then we would say, yes, this is, I will really be happy now. Oh, look, hey, I got a new car. Cool. I'll bet you're really happy now. Oh, I'm going to be really happy now that I found this new car. And the reason that we tease each other about, oh, you got a new shirt. Cool shirt. Are you happy? Oh, I'm so happy I bought this shirt. New haircut. Cool. Are you happy? And so we'd tease each other because we knew that it isn't true. You say, well, I'll be happy when I get this or that or the other thing. And you get it and you're not. And so we just laugh and joke. Nothing wrong with having that stuff. It's just if you think it's going to give you something, you reach out for it. It's like fog. That's the word. Vanity. And that's why it's rendered emptiness, meaninglessness, vanity, vain, useless, whatever. Breath, wind, striving after wind is another phrase, another way he puts it. So that's one of the main, if not the main, theme. The second main theme goes right along with it, and it's the theme of life under the sun. Under the sun. Look at verse 3 and 4. What advantage does man have in all of his work, which he does under the sun? Now that phrase, underline that phrase, and if you've never studied Ecclesiastes before, you need to be aware that the word vanity and the word under the sun go together. Because his whole vantage point is life in this world, essentially apart from God. Although what you'll find is that several times he will mention that he does believe in God, even though he's skeptical about this life. You will find several times in the book that this man definitely believes in God, and he'll bring it, we'll see it come out in the book. But his main perspective is life under the sun. The phrase is used 29 times, and it's only used in the book of Ecclesiastes. If you ever hear a verse, and you go to Bible trivia games, which some people like and some people don't, and the people who like them are the people who know a lot about their Bibles, and the people who don't are the people who should know more about their Bibles and don't. And so that's the way that breaks down. If you ever have a Bible trivia question that has the phrase under the sun in it, you know for sure it's from the book of Ecclesiastes. It's the only place it's found. And it's found 29 times. And the reason is because the second great theme is not just vanity, but vanity under the sun or under the heavens. Vanity, if what you're looking at is this world apart from God. And it's interesting because Koheleth, or Solomon, does not actually mention life after death. He doesn't talk about life after death. He doesn't talk about heaven. He doesn't talk about looking beyond. And we're very accustomed to this. As Christians, we're very accustomed to looking beyond. In fact, we've been in Hebrews on Sunday mornings where we're exhorted all the time to look into the next life and so on. But Koheleth doesn't do that. Solomon doesn't do that in this book. What he does is he says, this is life under the sun. And you might say, right now, you're probably thinking to yourself, well, then that means the whole thing is terrible. But that's not the conclusion that he comes to. It's only terrible under certain circumstances. So I want you to bear in mind, don't jump to premature conclusions. We'll see tonight three errors we have to stay out of after we've looked at the first couple of chapters here. So it's two main themes, vanity and under the sun. And by the way, I am convinced that's why that old rock and roll song was written from Ecclesiastes 3. And whenever I hear that song, I think to myself, there are moments when the world's approach to life overlaps just a little bit with God's wisdom. There are moments when people connect because the skepticism of our fallen world will connect from time to time with what God says. And the book of Ecclesiastes is a connecting point for people who are extremely realistic about our world. Even though they're not Christians, they look at the fallenness of it and they connect at that point. Okay? So watch for the themes of vanity and life under the sun and think to yourself, God is connecting with people who realize that this world is vain. Even though they haven't come to the Lord yet, they're realizing the world is vain, that the older you get, the less it has to offer you. That life under the sun seems extremely meaningless. God is connecting with them, and he connects through Ecclesiastes. Okay? So let's begin in chapter 1, verse 1. The words of Koheleth, the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Emptiness or vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. That's his theme. Now he begins to explain why he says it. He said, well, why are you so depressed, you know? Why are you bummed out? Why do you think everything's empty? Well, he says, what advantage does a man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also, the sun rises and the sun sets, and it's hastening to its place. It rises there again, blowing toward the south and turning toward the north. The wind continues swirling along, and on its circular course as the wind returns, all the rivers flow into the sea, and the sea is not full. You know, that's a great question. Did you ever have a little kid ask you, how come if all the rivers go into the ocean, it never fills up? And it never really gets empty either, it just kind of stays there. What he's getting at here is the sameness of life. The place that, the fact that it's got these recurring cycles over and over and over again. And in chapter 3, we probably won't make it all the way into chapter 3 tonight, but when he gets into chapter 3 and he mentions all the cycles and the patterns, there's a purpose for this. He says, look, it's the same year in and year out. Everything is wearisome. Verse 8. Man is not able to tell it. He can't even explain how bothersome it is. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. You never get satisfaction. That which has been is that which will be, That which has been done is that which will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Have you ever heard people say it? Oh, man, nothing new under the sun. What comes out of Ecclesiastes? That's a quote from the Bible. People quote Ecclesiastes. Actually, they quote Ecclesiastes in a couple of places that we're going to see that people don't really realize. But nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, this is, see this, it is new. Already it has existed for ages which were before us. You know, the news industry, I've got a book called How the News Makes Us Dumb. If you're interested, I'll recommend it to you. It's by a guy named Dr. Summers, who's a professor at the University of Florida. And interesting book, recently written, about news. And what it is it's a critique, it's an expose, not of the fact that news is biased, but the fact that it tries to crank itself out every single day. It tries to pretend that there's something brand new that's really important to you that has actually happened, brand new. That's why they call it news. See, because it's supposed to be new. And what Solomon says is nothing new under the sun. It's all been happening for a long time. And you know, it's true. You read an old newspaper, the names are different. The photos are different. The crimes are the same. The news is just changes from generation to generation. The only thing that changes is the names. The plot lines are the same. There's murder and rape and pillage, and then there's the economy, which is sort of similar to those things. And then there's what's happening in politics, which is also amazingly similar to those things, and so on and so forth. He says, there's nothing new under the sun. Human beings are human beings. They have the same drives. They have the same crimes. They have the same lusts. They have the same problems. From generation to generation, the only person who thinks it's new is somebody who's young. Have you ever had a young person come up and tell you a joke that's older than you are? And they think it's a new joke. Well, that's because to them it's new, but that's because they're young. Now, this guy's old who writes this. And so he says, you know what? I've been waiting for something new for a long time, and I've discovered there's nothing new. There's nothing new under the sun. Can anybody bring me anything and say, this is absolutely unique? There's never been anything like it. Not really. Did you ever watch the advertisements, like, say, the automobile advertisements? Every single one of them, you think there's never going to be a sale like this ever again, except they have one the following week. Every single one of them, just next time you're watching TV, watch the ads and how they hype themselves and the stuff and say, this is the best. This is the lean, mean grilling machine. Now, this is something new that you have to have. But it was a salad shooter a few years ago. And then before that, it was whatever the case may be. Always something that it has to hype itself as the new thing. And you go, I wonder. Well, that's exactly what he's getting at. And he's not so much depressed about it. He's just saying it's empty. It's possible to say this is empty and not be completely depressed. I am convinced that Solomon was not completely depressed when he wrote this. I believe that he was very realistic. But I don't think he was, and you'll see why I don't think he was depressed as we get through the book. So he says, who can tell me anything's new? Verse 11. There is no remembrance of earlier things, and also the latter things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still. In other words, we've forgotten generations past. And you know what? We're going to be forgotten. I read an interesting article about what would happen in 1,000 years if a bunch of people from another civilization, if the Lord doesn't come. It was a secular article. So let's pretend the Lord won't come, and there's another 1,000 years, and they dig us up. And they dig up our bones, and they dig up our civilization, and they say, wow. It was. And the whole article was about the fact that they could build a real good case for the fact that we worship Coca-Cola. Based on just digging up the stuff, if they dug up the right stuff, they might think that we were a culture that worshipped a little bottle that said Coca-Cola on it because of the songs. Huh? Some of the Coke songs that they have written are wonderful worship songs. Now let that sink in for just a minute, okay? So it's interesting. He says, generation will pass and these worlds will come and go. He says, no one's going to remember. And what they do dig up is not going to tell them the real story. We dig stuff up. We write learned books about a tooth we found. And we build an entire civilization around it. And he goes, you know what? It's just meaningless. From generation to generation, everything gets lost. Humans really don't know as much as they think they know. And so you build a monument to yourself. But you know what? It's going to get buried. They're digging up monuments that guys built to themselves thousands of years ago, digging them up all the time. Nobody ever heard of the guy. Can't even pronounce his name. Found a monument, lasted about a generation, till another guy came along and broke it, and then used it to build his monument. And he says, it's the way it is. It's this cycle. Nobody's going to remember you, and you don't remember anybody else. What a meaningless existence. It's true. It's true. Life under the sun. Verse 12. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under the heavens. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. Now that's something you can write down maybe about your own job. Maybe you could just take that. That's my life verse for my work. A grievous task that God has afflicted me with. Verse 14. I don't recommend that, actually. But he talks about his career in chapter 2. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, it's all empty, vanity, and striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. Isn't that interesting? I said to myself, behold, I've magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were before me over Jerusalem, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. That's why I think Solomon is the one who wrote this, because that describes him perfectly. But it's interesting that he says, I have all this wisdom, but look at verse 15. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. Have you ever seen situations in people's lives, and you think to yourself, or in the world, and you think to yourself, why can't this be straightened out? We have more books on self-help. We have more stuff that's supposed to straighten people out. And why doesn't it work? I read a true story about a guy who was a preacher for years, a minister of the gospel for years. And he retired and he became an undertaker. And they said, do you find fulfillment doing this? And he said, well, as a matter of fact, now when I straighten them out, they stay straight. I thought, you know what? He was being cynical about the ministry, and maybe that's why he left the ministry. But I thought to myself, how often do we look at the world and say, why is it that when I try and straighten something out, it doesn't stay straight? And here's Solomon with all this power and all this money, and he can't make it work consistently. You know, I've been a pastor for 20 years or so, and I have counseled people, and I've worked with people. And at times I think, yes, yes, it's working. And in other times, I think to myself, well, a lot of times, those very situations I think are going to be so great, sometime later, a month or two or 6 months or a year or a couple of years later, it blows up in my face. I think, Lord, where are you? And then other situations that I would not give a chance to. I would say, you know, this is a situation that I don't think is ever going to work. So-and-so's going out doing something. I don't think that's ever, and it just goes great. And God blesses it, and it's wonderful. And I think to myself, that's it. That's it. I'm cutting my head off. I'm cutting my tongue out. I am not doing any more advising. I advise this person. I think they're going right. I think the earth opens and swallows them. I tell this person not to do this, and God blesses it. What do you do? Okay, we're going to get to this. Because, see, that's part of what Solomon is saying. He says, look, I try to make things straight. It doesn't work. Things I think ought to be crooked, they work. What's the problem here? It's part of this emptiness. It creates frustration, that Latin term meaning empty. It makes you feel like, what's going wrong? I want you to hold that thought because it recurs over and over again, and we don't like feeling like that. We don't like feeling frustrated and not having the answers, but understanding this is so vital to really living a good life on earth. And you'll see how as we go through this. Believe it or not, it actually helps us to live a completely good life for the Lord. So he says, man, I've decided I'm going to figure this out. I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than everybody in Jerusalem. And my mind has observed wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And I'm going to set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I realize that this is also striving after wind. What he says is, I'm doing a research project. I'm going to start working on wisdom and folly. I'm going to figure out where they really are. What idiocy really is, and what real wisdom and knowledge are, I am going to work on this till I figure it out. But he says, when I did that, I found out it really didn't work. That in itself, even the research project didn't work. And you'll find that he says this over and over again. I decided to do this, but it didn't work. And then he describes it anyway. That's what he's going to do. I set my mind to know these things, but I found out, verse 18, in much wisdom there is much grief. Increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. Have you noticed that? Now, honest and truly, have you noticed that increased knowledge actually increases your pain? That the more you know, not only the more you know you don't know, we understand that part. I mean, the more you know, the more it hurts. When I was a kid and a young guy in ministry, and I'd ask the older guys in ministry questions, and they'd say, you don't want to know. I actually had a supervisor who, when I asked him questions about ministry, he said, you do not want to know that. And I thought he was lying. I thought, oh, come on, I do too. And now I want to know even more because you don't want to tell me. You know, I've discovered something. Now when people say, you don't want to know, I say, okay. I've learned. If somebody tells me I don't want to know something, they probably are correct. Because the more you know, the more pain you see, the more you understand, the more grief you actually endure. Now, I want you to understand this, because if you intend to serve God in a fallen world, and in order to do that, you have to have life experience, I guarantee your life experience is going to have some trauma in it. Because you can't just serve God in a fallen world from a position of protection. You have to be involved. And that's going to involve trauma. And also something else. Since this is true, imagine how much Jesus knew and hurt. Do you ever wonder why he cried in John 11 when he came upon Lazarus' tomb and there was Mary and Martha, and Martha came out and met him and said, Lord, if you'd have been here, he wouldn't have died, and so on. And Jesus knew he was going to raise him from the dead. He specifically waited till he died in order to do that miracle, to come and bring him back from the dead. Yet Jesus is not happy at the time that he's there. In fact, he comes to the tomb and he weeps. It's a real emotional moment. In fact, it says, the Greek word means to weep convulsively before he brought him back. Why? Why would Jesus weep convulsively at a time when he's going to bring his friend Lazarus back from the dead and do this huge miracle? And everybody's good. I would have been excited. I would have been just busting my buttons thinking, man, I'm going to surprise these people. We're going to bring him back from the dead. This is going to be so cool. They're crying now, but they are going to be so happy in a minute. And it's true, they were very happy. But he was not during that period of time. Now, why was that? Because he not only did he know that he was going to bring him back from the dead, he knew why he died. And he understood death. And he knew that bringing Lazarus back was not going to solve the problem. He knew he was going to have to solve the problem. And in order to solve the problem, he was going to have to go through death. Now, all of this was going on in his mind, and not a bit of it was going on in anybody else's mind on that day when they were so happy. He entered into their happiness, but at a deeper level, he understood. You know why? Because with great knowledge comes grief in a fallen world. And you're wise if you understand that. It doesn't mean there's never any joy. It just means the more you know, the more you understand about real life, the more you're going to realize grief is a part of it. Still, this author does not despair of life. You'll see as we go through. So then he goes on with the research project. He says, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself. And that too was futility. He says, so here's the first part of my research project. I am going to find anything that anybody can imagine to make themselves happy. Now, he had all the money anybody could ever want. And he had all the power. He was a king. He didn't have to answer to anybody. He could just say, I want what I want. And we fantasize about a life like this. Don't you fantasize about a life? Don't you say, wouldn't it be fun to have $1 million and do whatever we want with it? And wouldn't it be fun to run the world? Actually, I don't think it'd be fun to run the world, but it would be fun to be autonomous within the world, right? And do whatever we want. Well, he actually could do that. So he said to himself, I see that everything's kind of lousy. I'm going to try and figure out what makes life really tick, and I'm going to start with pleasure. I'm going to test myself with pleasure. So he does this in several different ways, and you'll see it all the way down through. He checks humor, substance abuse, projects and possessions, verses 4 through 8, sex and fame. He starts with humor. I said of laughter, I checked it out. I don't know what he did. Maybe hired comedians to come in and laugh for him. I don't know. But he said, I said of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish when it was all over? So then I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely. Now, it seemed to me that those two things don't go together well. I mean, you know, the minute you start doing that, your mind isn't guiding you very well after the first few minutes, it would seem. So he'd have to do it a little bit at a time. You know what he's doing? He really did do this. What he did is he set it up so that he could probably evaluate how out of control you would have to be before you considered yourself having a good time. And then after you sobered up, how much better you felt about your life after that. Now, those of you who remember, and you don't have to raise your hands, but those of you who remember using substances in this world in order to give you a little bit of happiness might understand a little bit of the experimentation he was going through here. He says, I tried wine, and I tried it to see if it would make me happy, and it didn't. My mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven in the few years of their lives. He looked around at all the foolish things. He went and he checked and he looked and he entered in to the foolish things people said were fun. People said, this is fun. Come do this. He said, all right, I'll try that. And then he got to the end of it and he said, if that's all there is, it's a waste of time for my few years here. Then he says, how about projects and possessions? I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. And I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. And I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. That's amazing. And I bought male and female slaves, and I had homeborn slaves. And also I possessed flocks and herds larger than all those who preceded me in Jerusalem. I know what? It'll make me happy if I'm able to build. I'll create. I'll make something. And he did it with all the money and all the architects and the whole deal. He put the whole thing together. Didn't do it for him. He even went into, in those days, he bought slaves and he bred slaves. That was not uncommon in that era. Not uncommon at all. He said, maybe I can do this by manipulating people. Maybe that will make me feel better. I'll have power over people. Didn't work. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold and treasure of the kings of kings and provinces. And I provided for myself male and female singers. So I've got money and music and the pleasures of men, many concubines, a harem, I think it's rendered in the NIV. If it was Solomon, he had 300 wives, 700 concubines for a total of 1,000 women. So he's a guy who knows what he's talking about when he talks about sex, and when he talks about the pleasures that sexuality can bring. And he says, it's empty. 1,000. Then I became great. Now we move into fame. I became great and increased more than all those who preceded me in Jerusalem, and my wisdom stood by me. And all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold from my heart any pleasure. For my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done, and the labor which they had exerted, and behold, it was all vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. The whole, okay, end of that chapter. So then he goes, all right, verse 12 to 17, he finishes the section of his research on pleasure. He says, all these things are supposed to bring pleasure. Didn't answer my big questions. So then he says, I'll go after the education. I turn to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. For what will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? And I saw that wisdom excels folly as light exceeds darkness. Better to be smart than stupid. Better to have an education. Better to choose wisdom. I saw that. The wise man's eyes are in his head. I like that. I like that. Now, I want you to think about that phrase for just a minute. Did you ever know somebody whose eyes were not in their head? I want you to hold that thought and use it. We should pick these out and use them from time to time. When you see a person who's really like not thinking clearly, a good way to describe them is their eyes are not in their head. A wise man's eyes are in his head. That's good. The fool walks in darkness, and yet I know that one fate befalls them both. I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. There's no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool. Inasmuch as it is in the coming days, he will still be forgotten, and how the wise man and the fool die alike. So I hated life, For the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after wind. You know what he did? He said, you know, it's really good to live a wise life, but I notice I have to plan my funeral just like that guy has to plan his funeral. And if that's true, if mortality is really the end of it, what good is it? And here we get into the whole idea of under the sun, you see. Mortality is a great evangelistic tool, because when we start seeking after that which the world can offer, God's word keeps saying the world can offer you only 6 feet of ground. That's it. That's what the world's going to offer you in the long run. And that's what he came up with, even in the whole educational thing. He goes after the wisdom. He says, wisdom is good. Knowledge is good. But we're going to die. Where did that get me? He says, nowhere. Then verses 18 and following, he looks at his career. Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor, for which I had labored under the sun. For I must leave it to the man who comes after me. And who knows whether he's going to be a wise man or a fool. Yet he will have control over the fruit of my labor, for which I labored by acting wisely under the sun. And this too is vanity. Therefore I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor, for which I had labored under the sun. There's that phrase over and over. When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them, this too is vanity and a great evil. For what does a man get in all his labor and all his striving with which he labors under the sun? Because all his days his task is painful and grievous. Even at night his mind does not rest. This too is vanity. You know what he's talking about is the guy who is so intent on success that even at night he can't think of anything but the money he's making or the business he's doing or whatever it is, and he just goes and goes and goes. But then he dies and he leaves it to somebody who didn't earn it. And he goes, that's the part I really hate. That's the part I really hate. I worked so hard for this. I have to leave it to a guy who didn't even earn it. And that bothers me so much, it makes life look empty. Absolutely true. Have you seen that bumper sticker, we're spending our kids' inheritance? These are people who've read this. They've decided not to leave it. Verse 24. Now, this is one of several places. Verse 24, and I want you to watch as you read Ecclesiastes. This is one of several places where he gets down to what he believes is worthwhile. And you may look at it and say to yourself, I'm not sure I agree with him. But before you make that judgment, let's just read what he says. There is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I've seen, and it is a gift from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without the Lord? For to a person who is good in the Lord's sight, the Lord has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner he has given the task of gathering and collecting so that he may give it to the one who is good in God's sight. And this too is vanity and striving after wind. Now notice that last line. You see how he's contrasting the goodness of God and the vanity of the world around him? And he comes to the final conclusion here, and then he comes to it again and again. And I challenge you to read Ecclesiastes in these next few weeks and mark all the places where he comes to the conclusion that it's okay to enjoy the life that God has given you. Because if God has given it to you as a gift, you should just relax and enjoy it. Because you're not going to be able to hold on to it. You can only take one day at a time. And we're going to come back to that in just a moment. But notice that that's his conclusion. He says everything's vain, everything's useless. But then you would think that he would do what the existentialists do, and that is commit suicide. It's all meaningless, so the only question left is whether or not to commit suicide. He does not come to that conclusion. Instead of saying that it's all so worthless I'm going to kill myself, he comes to the conclusion it's all so worthless I'm going to enjoy myself. And that's why I believe he really knew God. That's why I believe that the wisdom of Ecclesiastes is not depressing. So let's back up, and we'll close this particular Bible study with just some things that this research project he does teaches us. And we're going to see them over and over again as we work our way through the chapters of Ecclesiastes. This skepticism, this backdoor look at life that Solomon comes to, reveals three really, really common errors that you're going to find if you haven't already. And if you do take notes, note these three. The first is this: the error of thinking that substance can actually be found on earth without God. Of course, you can see that clearly. It's a huge error that is super common in our world. And the backdoor view, coming in the back door into wisdom, makes it very clear what that error is. He says it really is emptiness. And when you read it, if you get really depressed and you look at it and you go, that's the way my life really is. My life is really this depressing. Then, my friend, you know what? You're viewing life with the idea that you can acquire it here. You really do believe that you can get fulfillment here on earth. If when you read Ecclesiastes, you believe that your life is as depressing as his, then what you're seeing is life only under the sun. See? So the first big error that he blows to smithereens is the idea that you can find substance. It's the opposite of substance. It's vanity. If all the meaning is here on earth, he says, I can't find it anywhere. As soon as I get it, it's not there. So he's disillusioned. But disillusionment has a very good purpose. Disillusion means to be set free from an illusion. So disillusionment, as painful as it is, can actually be the beginning of wisdom in a person's life. If you've been living in an illusion, if you've been living in denial about how life is and trying to find happiness, no wonder you're depressed. Now, the first error is the error of thinking that substance can actually be found on earth. And by the way, that error is the error you will learn in almost all the school systems, especially in higher education. It's the error you will learn there. There's actually a name for it. The idea that substance, real substance, is only found in the universe. It's called philosophical naturalism. And if you don't know that phrase, you should know it. Philosophical naturalism. Remember it. It's the idea that all there is the physical universe. Remember Carl Sagan? He died in 1996. So he knows better now. But while he was an active astronomer, and by the way, I found out he was the father of exobiology. Do you know what exobiology is? I didn't either, but I thought it was a pretty cool sounding title. He's an exobiologist and an astronomer. I thought, that is very cool. And then I looked up, astronomist I knew, exobiologist. You know what that is? It's the science of finding life on other planets. That's exobiology. And he spent a long time theorizing about life on other planets. He did the TV series Cosmos and the book Cosmos. Now listen to the phrase from Cosmos, the opening line of Cosmos. And it was repeated over and over again, and he capitalized it. Quote, the cosmos is all there is, all there ever was, all there ever will be, end quote. And then they would play the music and show pictures of space. And then they would talk about how wonderful it is to be a child of the cosmos. That's philosophical naturalism. And that is exactly what Solomon said is complete emptiness. It's looking at this world and saying, this is all there is. And it's the main thought process going on in our world today. In fact, Chuck Colson's new book, How Now Shall We Live, is based on basically debunking that whole idea that the physical world is all there is. So Solomon was into debunking it 1,000 years before Christ. And he says it is useless. Jot down 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 to 17, and look it up when you get a chance. But it says, 1 John chapter 2, 15 to 17. It says, do not love the world. You know what the Greek word for world is? Cosmos. That's the Greek word for world. Do not love the cosmos, says John. Neither the things that are in the cosmos, says John. Because the things that are in the cosmos are passing away, and also all the desires of it. He doesn't mean not to love the people. He doesn't mean not to enjoy life as God has given it. What he means is don't worship the cosmos. Carl Sagan and our entire culture is worshiping the cosmos. Solomon says, emptiness. Emptiness. Here's the second error. It's the error of thinking, and this is an error that Christians fall into, and Ecclesiastes blows it away, is the error of thinking that knowing God will answer all your questions about life. And this is something a lot of Christians really believe in their souls, and it's because a question hasn't arisen that they care about very much, that they haven't got an answer to. But when that happens, when a question comes up in a Christian's mind that they can't answer and God doesn't give them the answer to it, they get really ticked off. And the reason is because they never figured that God would do stuff they wouldn't understand. So let me tell you that error again that Ecclesiastes blows away. It's the error of thinking that knowing God will answer all your questions about life. Christian friend, your life can be an absolute confusion at times. Stuff can happen to you that you had not planned, that you wish you could get out of, And that you look out to God and you say, what in the world are you doing? I gave my life to you. You're tearing it to pieces. You got to have room for that. Ecclesiastes, when he goes through all of the questions and the hassles and still comes to the conclusion that he needs to continue trusting God, what he's saying is you got to have room in your theology for confusion, for a lot of unanswered questions. Because life doesn't work the way, and when I question or when I look at folks and give them advice and they don't take my advice and they prosper wonderfully, and then I give another person advice, they take my advice and their life just falls apart. And I think to myself, what good is this advice giving? What I am doing is right then realizing that God doesn't always make it work out the way we think it should. Doesn't always go according to the way the book says, our instruction book or whatever it is. Christian, realize from Ecclesiastes that God allows things we don't understand. And this author comes to that final conclusion. Make room in your theology for it. And jot down Romans 8, 19 to 23. It says that the Lord subjected the world to futility, to frustration. Same concept in that Greek word there. He's purposely using it. He's using the frustration. And what that means is, you guys, and that brings us to the third error. I'll give it to you. I'll give you the error and then I'll explain it. The error that we need to stay out of and that Ecclesiastes blows away is the error of thinking that life on earth should not be enjoyed even though it's temporary. The error of thinking that life on earth should not be enjoyed even though it's temporary. Now, this is an error that a lot of Christians fall into, who the other two, the first two errors, you're thinking, hey, man, I got that one. Hey, oh, and I got that one, too. I got room in my theology for all kinds of stuff to go wrong. And I'm not a philosophical naturalist. I believe in God. I've given my life to God. But you know another trap that Christians fall into? And that is the idea that if you're enjoying any part of your life, you probably are in sin. There's probably something wrong with it, because if you read the book, if you read the Bible, you find out it says, don't love the world or the things that are in the world. And you say, but there's some things about my life I really love. I like this and I like that and I'm enjoying it. And so what you do is you don't talk about it. You just kind of run off and sneak off and enjoy it. And then you come to church and look sad or serious. I'm very serious. And then you leave and you go, yahoo! Get to go do something fun. But you don't tell other Christians, because fun is not supposed to be spiritual. And enjoying what's going on in your life at any point, that's not cool for a lot of folks who think that holiness is the same as sadness. Okay? But Ecclesiastes blows that away. It blows it away. What Ecclesiastes actually says over and over again is, my friend, listen, you are never going to figure out everything that goes wrong in your life. So the stuff that goes right in your life, you should enjoy a lot. And the end result is, don't commit suicide, commit fun. Enjoy the stuff that is good, because enough sad stuff is going to happen. Tony Campolo tells a story about when his children were tiny, and he took them to Disneyland, and there's Space Mountain. I mean, I remember when Space Mountain was built. I remember waiting for it to be finished when I was a kid so that we could go and see it. It's been there, it's ancient of days now, but this little one went on Space Mountain. After they went on it, you know the lines, you know, you get old waiting to get on these things. And after, he wanted to go back on it, and Campolo said, we don't have the time, we don't have the money to go on this. And his little one, his little boy, said, Daddy, Jesus wants me to go. He's learning. As a Christian, he's learning. Jesus wants me to go. And Tony Campolo said, what? What are you talking? Daddy, in church, you said, Jesus understands all of our feelings. He knows everything we feel. And when we feel sad, he feels it with us. And when we feel joyful, he feels it with us. Yes, that's true, son. Well, when I'm having a really good time on Space Mountain, that means Jesus is having fun with me. And I think he would like another ride. Well, you know what's weird is, that's not bad theology. I mean, the little guy's using it to get what he wants. But you know, I don't want you to read the book of Ecclesiastes and say to yourself that the end of all of this is that in order to be holy, I got to be depressed. I got to not enjoy my life. I got to not like Christmas. I got to not like presents. I got to not like Christmas carols and all of the traditions and everything that comes along with Christmas. I got to not like that in order to be holy. I got to kind of throw a little cold water on everything every once in a while, just to make sure everybody knows I'm really walking with God. That it's exactly the opposite. It's exactly the opposite. And you know what sets you free to do this? To live a life that you can actually enjoy in the grace of God? You know what sets you free? It's knowing that your life really isn't here. You're not looking for the ultimate fulfillment here, so you're free to enjoy it. This isn't the end-all and be-all of eternity. This is only a temporary place. But there's a lot of fun in it, a lot of good, and that's why Koheleth says, Solomon says, you know what I've discovered? A fella ought to just live his life and enjoy the good parts of it. And he goes on and he gives more advice along the way until he gets to the very end of the book. And he says, and you know what? You ought to start serving the Lord and following your desire for him when you're young. Because that's the right thing to do. You're going to not live forever anyway. So you might as well start learning this wisdom now. He gets further and further on into it. It's a wonderful piece of wisdom. So, you know, lighten up. Lighten up if you're just too serious. You say, oh yeah, but grief is around. Yeah, grief is there. It's there. God will help you deal with it. And there's a time to cry, but there's a time to laugh. And if it's time to laugh, then laugh hard. If it's time to play, play hard. When it's time to grieve, you'll be able to grieve hard. Live your whole life. That's the way the Hebrews really did. And you know, they knew that every bit of their life was redeemed. Every bit of it. That's why I like Ecclesiastes.